Stand by for the Terry Saul Show. 5. Roll tape. 4. Cue Terry. 3. Bring audio up. 2. Stand by. 1. Play intro.
Stay tuned for the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM. Today's show is being brought to you by the Lule Group, featuring Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule's State Farm Insurance.
Well, good morning and welcome to the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station. We are KSLM AM and FM. I am your host, and I'm so glad that you joined us this morning, or if you're listening to the replay, it's this evening. Now, today's special guest we had in here about a year or so ago, he is the author of a book that I will tell you is one of the scariest books I've ever read in my life, but it's also a true book. Everything in this thing is completely true. His name is Larry Crompton. Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fine.
On the second, first of all, welcome back. You were here about a year or so ago, and we talked about this this whole situation, which we're going to talk about today. But I read the book here. I'm in the process of reading it a second time. And you state you don't want to read this book at night. I started reading it the other night, and I thought, oh, boy. So I got up, and my wife says, where are you going? I go, oh, I'm just going to check the doors, make sure everything's locked up. This is a true story. Before we get into this, tell me a little bit about yourself now. You worked for who?
I was with the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department.
Okay. For how long were you with them?
I was with them for 28 years. I started out in patrol, and then they put me into undercover narcotics for 3 years. Once I got out of that, my wife forced me to get out of it. And
they have a way of doing that, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. And it was something different.
Where is Contra Costa County? That's in the Bay Area?
It's in the Bay Area. It's between San Francisco and Sacramento.
Okay, well, that's quite a big stretch, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we had a big area.
Yeah.
And when I was in narcotics, I'd work for different counties. They'd call the sheriff and ask if they could borrow me.
What was your specialty?
I worked deep undercover at times, but...
And you wonder why the wife says, get out of this line of work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was dangerous.
Sure,
and,
sure.
Had a few times where it came very close.
Yeah. And, got a little hairy there.
Yes.
How long ago was that? When did you leave?
I left in 98.
Okay, so it's been a while since you've been gone.
Oh, yes.
And can you imagine doing that work right now?
No, I would not want to. Our son retired a little over a year ago. He was in law enforcement. Very glad that he's out of it. And the way that it's going right now is not in the right direction.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's very, very bad.
It's scary.
It is.
My son is a paramedic up in Portland. I have a scanner that he probably wishes I didn't have anymore because I'm listening to him all the time and it scares the hell out of me. As a paramedic, they're giving these paramedics now vests to wear for their own protection. It's just scary.
It is. It's a different world right now.
It certainly
and it's
is.
Going in the wrong direction.
I think so. And hopefully it'll get changed. There is a book out. It's called The Cold Case Files: Sudden Terror. And first of all, the reason for the name Sudden Terror is because if you start reading this thing, it scares the hell out of you.
It does.
It is the true story of California's most famous sexual predator. He was known as the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, he was the original Night Stalker in Southern California.
Okay. We're gonna get into this, and towards the end of today's show, we're going to have an update on this because he has been caught. But it took a while, and we'll get into this. First of all, what happened? Let's go back. What year are we talking about?
Well, I didn't know about it at the time, but he started in June of 1976 in Sacramento.
Okay.
With his rapes. Unfortunately, back in those days, if you didn't live in the town where it was happening or the city where it was happening and get that newspaper, you didn't know about it. Didn't know about it until August of 1977, and that's when two of the Sacramento Sheriff's Office detectives come down, Lieutenant and Sergeant, and said they wanted to have a meeting with us in Contra Costa County.
Did they tell you about what?
Not at the time.
Okay.
And when they got there, they got telling us that there was a East Area Rapist that had been hitting in Sacramento and other cities up there. And there had been 37 attacks that we knew nothing about. And like I said, if you don't live in the town back then, you didn't know about it.
So you didn't have, well, I know obviously you didn't have the internet and Facebook or whatever the social media was to say, hey, this is what's going on. No. But the agencies didn't tell each other? I mean, there wasn't a statewide Ebola that would go out and say, hey, this is what we're doing?
No. Back then, a lot of the agencies didn't work together, as a matter of fact. And we found that out even more as we were working this case. But when Sergeant Bevins and Lieutenant Root come down and had the talk with us, and they said, he's been hitting in our area, and we think he's going to come down to your area.
Why did they think that?
Don't know. He did mention a couple of times in some of the rapes that he was going to Los Angeles. And
Who did he mention that to? The person, the victim?
To the victims, yes. Yes. This
okay. Wait. Let me stay on that. He would say he just raped the victim, or he's raping the victim. And by the way, I'm heading to L.A.
During the time that he was in the house, he would tie them up.
Okay.
He would search through the house and tell him he wanted money, and said he needed gas for his van. He's going to Los Angeles.
Okay.
And,
okay.
Things like that.
Okay.
The thing that they mentioned to us when they were talking was that the rape was not his number one motive. It was the terror that he put in him. And the first 16 attacks in their area was just women in the house. And here's something that a lot of people don't know and didn't realize back then, but out of the first 10 attacks by this rapist, six of them were teenagers. Two of them were 15 years old.
Oh, come on.
Once he did move down to our area and continued, there were more teenagers attacked, and two of them were 14 years old. So you can tell that sex was not what he was after. And like I said, the first 16 attacks were just women. And then apparently it was in the newspaper that he had never hit a house with a man in the house. His next attack, there was a man in the house.
He wanted to prove the newspaper wrong?
He just wanted to prove, I think, to himself that he could do whatever he wanted.
So Larry, he had to be stalking these people before, didn't he?
Oh,
yes. He just wouldn't walk into a house where the woman was there by herself. He had to know.
He knew where he was going. He knew who he was after. And some of these, he would go into the house when there was nobody home and set the house up by unlocking a window, putting shoelaces under a pillow or something in the house so that they would already be there. And he would go through the neighborhood and know which ones he was going to hit. What he would do would be tie them up, tie the woman up, and then he would go through the house and he'd tell him he'd want money and searching for money. And then he would tell him that he was going to have sex with him and that they had to do what he told them to do. And then when it started with a man in the house, he would throw the shoelaces on at the woman and tell her, tie him up, tie his hands behind his back, and the woman would have to do this. And then he would tie the woman up, and then he would retie the man. And he would tie the man's hands so tight that he would lose all feeling in his hands, and he'd do the same with his feet. And then he would rummage through the house, and then he would come back and say, okay, I'm taking your wife into another room. And he would remove the wife off the bed, take her into another room and tell her to get on the floor. And then he would take dishes back into where the husband was.
Dishes?
Yes,
okay.
Dishes. And put them on his back and tell him, if I hear these rattle, I will kill your wife. If I hear these,
oh,
I
word.
Will. If there was a child in the house, he would say, I'd cut your child's ear off and bring it to you. And
oh,
the whole
word.
Thing was a terror that he was putting in him.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when I finally did get involved, I would talk to the man and know how he was going through this. He felt that he was there to protect his wife.
Sure.
And
sure.
didn't. And I would tell him, if you had done anything, you'd both be dead. he would have killed you.
So how did he gain entry into the house then? He would wait until the people would go to sleep, obviously?
Oh, yes.
And then he would, what? I mean, he knew the layout of the dwelling. Yeah. So he'd get in there, and how would he wake them up? Just turn on the light, say hello?
He would shine a light on them and wake them up that way and point a gun at them and tell them, I have a gun, and I will shoot you. And don't move, and he would put the terror in them and make sure that they did. And a couple of times when the man would start to move, that's when he'd tell him, I will kill you.
How big of a guy is he? I mean, is he big enough that he can overpower people like this?
No, it wasn't that. He was always wearing a mask, so they wouldn't see his face.
Okay.
And he always wore gloves. He would make sure that the lights were out except what he wanted on. If he would move him into another room and the television was in there, he may turn the television on but the sound off so that there would be a little bit of a light, but that would be it. And he
did his homework, didn't he?
Oh, yes. And like I said, he would go through the neighborhood. He would know where he was going to hit. He would know who he was after. And there was a couple of times when things didn't go exactly the way that that he had planned, but he still stayed with it and did what he had to do.
So in order for him to do everything that you just explained, he's in that house for quite a while. It's not just get in there, do the deed, and then get out. He's in there.
There was times he would be in there for 2 or 3 hours.
Really?
Yes. And there was times when he was there many, many times. While he had them tied up, he would go into the kitchen and eat and tell them he was hungry. And they would hear him in there. And then he would come back. And then he'd take the wife and he'd untie the wife's feet.
Okay.
And get her off off the bed, but he would keep her hands tied behind her back, and her hands would be as tight as he would have on the husband.
Okay.
So that she would lose all feelings
sure.
in him, and
so,
we get him out there.
We have a couple minutes left on this particular segment here, but okay, so the authorities came from, what, Sacramento down to your area there, and then they told you that there's a good chance he was coming down your way? Did he come your way?
He did. When they were talking to us and we were listening to him and we were thinking, this is Contra Costa County. We don't have rapists like that down here. We don't have that. It's not going to happen here. Like I said, that was in August. In October, he hit us.
And you knew it was the same guy?
Well, at the time, we really didn't. He hit in Concord.
Okay.
And
Concord is just north of?
Concord is in Contra Costa County.
Okay, okay.
And it's in our area. But Concord didn't tell us about it at the time, that first one. And then a week later, hit Concord again. And we found out about it because they brought evidence over to the lab. And at the time, I was working in the crime lab. And the sheriff had transferred me there when I got out of narcotics. And so that was when we really found out what was going on and then got the reports. And I called Sacramento and Jim Bevins and let him know. And then Jim come down and we talked about it again and went over it again. And he said, yes, this definitely is the East Area Rapist. And he's in your area.
All right. So we need to take a short break. Don't go anywhere because this is going to get real interesting real fast here for you folks. You're listening to the Terry Saul Show on 104.3 FM and 1220 AM. Today's show is being brought to you by the Lule Group, Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule State Farm Insurance. Our guest is the author of Sudden Terror, the story of the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker. And like I say, this is a true story, and it's going to get real interesting, folks. We'll be back in just a moment. Stick around.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
We're back in 5, 4, Q-Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
Welcome back to the Terry Saul Weekend Show. We are talking with today's guest is for the author of Sudden Terror, Larry Crompton. And we're talking about the East Area Rapist, I guess you could say he is. And we'll get into what's happening to him now, which is some 40-some-odd years later there. But when we last spoke about it there, he had just hit Concord, which is the area that you were an officer with, sheriff's deputy with. What happened?
Once we found out about that, then I met with Jim Bevins, and he brought down reports of the rapes that they had up in Sacramento area and in some other areas. And like I said, we knew nothing about them. Sacramento was just an hour's drive, but he also hit in areas that were only probably 20, 30 minutes from us, but we knew nothing about them. So going through those reports, could see what we were looking at. Then he did hit us. And like I said, he hit Concord twice. We figured, yes, it is him. He's in our area. And it took a while before we really got to it. But
you had no clue who this guy was?
No idea
whatsoever who he was.
Nobody knew who he was. Nobody even explained too much about him where you would know who he was. Eventually, I had talked to psychiatrists about this, and they told me, if you come across him before he commits his crime, you are not going to be able to put him into that. He'll just be a normal person. You come across him after he commits a crime, he will kill you or he will kill himself. That's the kind of person he is. After I got into this, and like I said, I worked for the crime lab, so when a rape occurred, no matter where it was in our area, I would go there to process the scene and talk to the victims and see what was going on, and could see the terror that he was putting in these people. He hit Walnut Creek, and it was a 16-year-old girl.
Mm.
A detective or an officer that I knew in Walnut Creek, he called me, and he said, don't tell anybody I called you, because if you do, I could get fired. I'm not supposed to. But I
Larry, what
know.
Is the reason behind that? Why are these agencies not sharing information? I mean, the common goal is to catch this creep.
But that's the way it was. It worked that way. It just was very, very difficult to work with certain agencies.
Right.
This one here, I went over to where the rape occurred, and it was a 17-year-old teenager. And she had been babysitting at that house. And I got talking to her and said, how often do you babysit here? And she said, I haven't been here for about 2 months. In my mind, I thought this could not possibly be the person he was after, because he knew who he was going to hit and he knew when. So in talking to her, I found out she was sitting at the kitchen table doing her homework. And the door was open, but the screen door was closed. And he saw her through the screen door and watched her, and then he came in, and she heard him as he came in. He went through the work with her. I went to Walnut Creek, and I told him, I said, this is not who he's after. And they told me, we don't need you. We don't need your help.
Oh,
get
boy.
Out of my town. And I said, no, you don't understand. I said, he's going to hit you again, because this isn't who he's after.
Right.
And they said, we don't need your help. We will take care of it. And unfortunately, it wasn't too much later. It was 3 weeks later. I got another call from the same officer, and he said, we've been hit again. This was the one he was after to begin with. She was 13 years old. And I went and talked to her. And when I first saw her, I thought that she was at least a late teenager or maybe even 20 years old. She was a beautiful young girl, 13 years old, and that's what he did to her. And she has to live with that for the rest of her life. And those are things that you couldn't get out of your mind when I was dealing with these. Again, Walnut Creek told me, don't need your help, get out of my town. And very, very, very difficult when things like that happen.
That's gotta kind of piss you off in a couple of different directions, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Mainly because, first of all, she's 13 years old, and like you said, she's living with this the rest of her life.
Yeah.
And also, the agency says, we don't need your help, we'll take care of it.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. We didn't form our task force until December the 11th of 1978, after he had hit our area several times. And then the sheriff put us together and said, we definitely have got to work on this. And
So how many rapes at that point do you think he had committed by that point?
In our area at that time, before we even got involved in it, he had hit us 5 times.
Okay.
The only reason we were involved is, like I said, I was working in the crime lab.
Okay.
And I would go there to process the scenes. But other than that, once the task force was put together, there was deputies from our agency and from different cities in our county, and put a great detective task force together.
Okay.
And we all worked well together.
And how long did you work well before he was out of your area?
He left our area in 79.
Went where?
July. We didn't know. We just knew that he had left because he hadn't hit us in a few months.
Uh-huh.
And so at that time, we didn't know anything about it. It wasn't until January of the next year, 1980, that Jim Bevins called me. He was the detective from Sacramento, and said that he heard of a double homicide in Southern California. And he said, I think it's him. So he and I talked, and he said that happened in Santa Barbara. Said he called Santa Barbara, they wouldn't talk to him. So I called Santa Barbara, and they wouldn't talk to me either, and said, don't know what you're talking about. We haven't had anything like that. And that's where that part ended.
Okay. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, more with today's special guest, Larry Crompton, who is the author of Sudden Terror. And this is the story of the East Area Rapist, also known as the original Night Stalker. More in just a moment.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
We're back in 5, 4, Q Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
We are back. This is The Terry Saul Weekend Show on Salem's original radio station, KSLM AM and FM. I am your host. Today we're talking with author Larry Crompton. He's got a book out called Sudden Terror, and I'm telling you, you don't want to read this book at night because it is scary, and it's unfortunately, it's all true. So when we last left off there, Larry, you guys realized that this crazy guy is down now in the L.A. area. He's in Santa Barbara?
He hit in Santa Barbara, and it was Deborah Manning and Robert Offerman is who he hit and killed. And
but he hadn't killed before, though, had he?
He had, but we didn't know about it.
Okay.
There was a murder in Southern California that Claude Snelling was in 1975, and of course we didn't know about that. And even after we did get involved in this, we couldn't connect it, and nobody could. And then Katie and Brian Maggiore in Sacramento County, they were murdered in 1978. They couldn't really put it together that, yes, it was the East Area Rapist that did it, but they thought that it was.
So, Larry,
but at that time, we couldn't do it.
When he would commit the murder, was he going into the house with that in mind, I'm going to kill, or is he going there to a rape that went even more wrong than the act itself?
What happened was before we get into that, like I said, Jim Bevins and I knew about the double homicide. And then my sheriff sent me down to San Diego University to take a class down there. In that class, I happened to talk to a Santa Barbara deputy that was in the class. And he said, yeah, we had the double homicide. He said, a matter of fact, he said, we had an attempted rape just before that where the people got away. Well, the last attack in my area, the people got away. What happened was they knew of a victim in Sacramento, so they planned everything, if they were ever attacked, how to get out. And that's how they did get away. And really? The fellow himself was big enough to where he could have picked up this rapist and thrown him out, but won't get into that right now. But the wife escaped, and then he escaped. And then when we found out about this one in Santa Barbara where the people got away, that proved what we thought, that he wanted to kill. And when I talked to the doctor at the Vacaville Medical Center, where rapists and others are there, I gave her a couple of reports and then asked her to talk to the rapist. And then I went back a week later to talk to her. And she said, these rapists said, you had better catch him. He is going to kill. He wants to kill. She said, he is bad. And I said, he's bad. What about the rapists in here? She said, you got to understand, they don't think they're hurting anybody in here. It's for sex. With him, it isn't. Well, when the two people got away in my area, and then the first attack in Santa Barbara, the people got away there, that was when he said, it's never going to happen again. And it's like the doctor told me, once he finds the reason to kill, he is going to kill. But he has to have the justification. Right now, he hasn't had the justification. Well, that was the justification. Nobody's going to get away again. When he first killed the two, Offerman and Manning, he shot them and killed them. And then he realized that makes a lot of noise. After that, most of them, he just beat them to death. One of them, he just brought a piece of wood in with him and beat them with it. And that was his main thing. He would still go through with the rape, but one of the things that all of the victims said was that he was never fully erect, so it was not the sex. Mm-hmm. That was not the thing in his mind. It was what he wanted to do, and that was the murder. And his last murder, again, was a teenager, 19 years old.
And, were there ever any children in the house when this was happening?
Yes, definitely. What he would do with the children, sometimes there was one where he took the child and put her in the bathroom and turned the light off in the bathroom, and she reached up to turn the light back on, and he shoved her and turned the light off and told her, don't touch it again, and shut the door. And then took the mother into another room and did that. There was another one where the son was in bed with her. It was early in the morning. Her husband had just left for work. And she heard somebody in the house. She thought it was her husband coming back. And it wasn't. It was this. And he took her son off the bed, tied him up, and put him in another room.
Imagine the trauma for the child. I mean, let alone the victim, but the child to see that.
Yeah. Well, ended up with divorces because the husband felt that they were supposed to be there to protect their wife.
Sure.
And some of them were boyfriend and girlfriend, and it went bad in many ways, but some of them were able to live with it and deal with it.
Yeah.
But so, very, very hard to do that.
Now he's down in the L.A. area. He'd hit a couple of places in Santa Barbara and did a couple of homicides down there.
Yes.
So where did you guys come involved with?
Once I found out about the attempted rape where they got away, the detective from Sacramento and I, we worked together continually after that. I mean, anything that I heard, I got with him. Anything he heard, he got with me. We found out about other homicides down there, but again, we got no cooperation and really couldn't do anything with any of it. And then I retired, and Jim Bevins retired before I did, and he said, my head, my brain is so fouled up, he said, I can't deal with this anymore. And that's the way that that a lot of this worked.
So I moved up here
to Oregon.
Okay, what year was that?
98.
Okay, had he still been attacking people up to that point? So when was his last attack, do you guys think?
His last attack that we knew of was 1986. And like I said, at that time, we didn't know about it. That was the teenager, Janelle Cruz.
Okay.
But we didn't find out about all of those until in 2000, I got a phone call from Paul Holes. He worked in the crime lab in Contra Costa County, where I had worked at that time, and said that somebody told him that I was on the task force,
mm-hmm.
and said that he was a DNA expert, and if I could give him some names, he would do the DNA, see if they could join it, as all of these the same person. So I gave him three names, and he called me back about 4 months later.
Were these three names that you give him people of interest that you
they
thought?
They were in my cases.
Okay.
And I gave him those names, and then he called me back and said, yeah, we joined them. That those three are all the same rapist. And I said, okay. I said, I know of five homicides in Southern California. At that time, that's all I knew was the five of them. And I said, I can't get any cooperation down there, but if you can get a criminalist down there, I know they have evidence, and I know their murderer is our rapist. And if you can get somebody down there to cooperate, I know you can join them. So I told him about that, and he called me back 7 months later. And he said, no, they didn't have that. They had 10 homicides. And he said, we just joined six of them. And Orange County wants you down there to talk to them because they know nothing about the rapes. Well, I had all of the reports from Northern California, not just my area. I had them in all areas. And when I got when the task force was shut down and I got transferred, I went back into my office one time and a few weeks later, and there were a bunch of boxes in there. And I asked the sergeant, I said, what is this? And he said, oh, those are all the reports. He said, Sheriff said, we don't have room for them, so we're going to get rid of them. And I said, no, you're not. So I took and put them in the trunk of my car, and I kept them ever since.
Yeah.
And when I left California, I brought them to Oregon with me. So when Orange County said they wanted me down there, I called and talked to Larry Poole, the sergeant in Orange County. And I said, why don't you come up here? I said, I have contact with the sheriff's department up here. I have all the reports, and I'm sure they will copy them for you and get them. He said, no, the sheriff wants you down here. We'll pay for everything and bring the reports with you if you can. So I did. I spent the week down there with them and going over the reports. They knew nothing about the rapes at all.
And at this point, you still have no suspect yet. You don't know who it is.
No.
Okay.
We did not know anything. They did not know anything about who the suspect was. They had nobody in mind at all. And it was just a same thing. The only thing that they knew down there was that he tied the people up, even though he killed them. And then when he learned about DNA, I guess, he started taking the shoelaces and the ropes with him. He wouldn't leave them there just for that reason. They had all that evidence that they had, and the ones that escaped knew that he was wearing a mask, and the same things connected.
And no vehicle was seen at all in any of these things, and no dogs were barking or anything?
He didn't seem to have a problem with dogs, and we found out later after we knew who he was that he had a dog repellent that he used. We'll get into that later.
Boy, he just did his homework, didn't
he? Oh, yes. He knew everything that was going on in the house. And like I said, he would go into the house many times and set it up and make sure that it was there. Sometimes he cut the lines for the phone and had it all connected.
Amazing. Well, we need to take a short break. Don't go anywhere, folks, because this is going to get real interesting here in our last segment, because we find out who he is, where he's at, and what he's doing right now. Our guest is Larry Crompton, who is the author of Sudden Terror. And this is a fascinating book, which I guess you don't want to read this book at night before you conk out there, because you're gonna have nightmares about this thing. A quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting warmed up. Today's show is being brought to you by the Lule Group, Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule, State Farm Insurance. You're listening to Terry Saul Show on 104.3 FM and 1220 AM KSLM.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
Back in 5, 4, Q Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
We are back with our final few minutes. We're talking to author Larry Crompton, who is the author of The East Area Rapist and The Original Night Stalker, a crazy person in California that basically terrorized the state of California. How many rapes and attacks did he actually do that you guys know of?
We know that he did 50 rape attacks.
Over what period of time?
That was from 76 until his last attack was in 1986.
Okay, so
that was
about
his last homicide that we know of. So we had 50 rapes and we had 13 homicides that we finally were able to put together.
Okay. You guys caught this guy. When was he caught?
He was caught April the 24th of 2018.
Just recently?
Yes. And what happened?
What the hell has he been doing all these years?
We don't know. And I hope that that is something that will come out later, because he could not have stopped in 86, not because of the way that he was. Can't believe that he would have stopped.
Did this guy work?
Yes, yes.
What did he do for a living?
He was a police officer.
Oh, come on.
In Exeter, California for 3 years. He left Southern California, and then he came to Northern California and was hired by the Auburn Police Department. That was in 1976, and that's when the rapes started up here in Northern California. He was there for 3 years, and then he got caught shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. They fired him.
Do you think that he committed any of these crimes while on duty?
I don't think he was on duty, but I think he set it up while he was on duty.
Okay. Because that's a little bit of a drive from Auburn down to some of the other areas, Concord and stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but by the time he come down to us, he had already been fired.
Okay.
So it wasn't that. But yes, he did. There was two that I happened to find out. I went to Berkeley to talk to a detective down there who was working on the stinky rapist. And he told me of two attacks that happened down in San Jose. And I said, oh, I never heard of them. And he said, no. He said, San Jose, if the victim doesn't know who the rapist is, it's not investigated.
Seriously?
It's just put aside. He said, they are so busy on other crimes.
My old stomping ground, San Jose. I was born and raised there.
Yeah.
So how did this guy get caught? First of all, what's his name?
His name is Joseph James D'Angelo.
Okay. If you've seen any of the news things, they've shown him going in. Now, I saw a newscast the other day where he's in a wheelchair. So I'm not sure how old he must be at this point. Late 70s?
When he first started the rapes in Sacramento, he was 34.
Okay.
When he was arrested, he was 72.
Okay.
What happened was his niece, I believe it was, put in her DNA for the genetic genealogy.
Oops.
And what happened, Paul Holes, like I said, the criminalist with Contra Costa County, was still working on the DNA thing to join. So this did join. It put together several names.
Okay.
And they got it down to two. And then they started following Joseph James DeAngelo for a week. And they got his DNA off the door handle of his car, watching it, and a piece of paper he threw away. So they put that together.
Garbology 101, is that what they called it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they got that and said, yes, it is him. They remembered what the psychiatrist said. You got to be careful. He'll kill himself or he'll kill you. So they waited outside of his house until he came out, and that's when they arrested him.
Okay.
And like I said, that was April the 24th of 18. The first thing out of his mouth was, I have a roast in the oven. I need to go in. I have a roast in the oven. And, of course,
Wait a minute.
That's where his gun was.
Uh-huh.
And that's where he wanted to go.
Do you think it was to shoot it out or murder by suicide by cop? Or,
yes. He would have definitely taken it both ways.
Okay.
So they finally got him. They finally got him into court June the 29th of this year. And he pled guilty to 13 murders, 13 parts of the rapes. Of course, the you can't get them on everything because the statute of limitation is out on rapes. But when he kidnapped during those rapes to do robberies, they were still able to charge him. So they charged him with 13 of those also.
Okay.
And he pled guilty to all of these in court. Now, they brought him in a wheelchair.
He didn't look very healthy when they brought him in.
No, he certainly didn't. Then he found out that the week that they followed him, he was on a motorcycle doing 100 miles an hour on videotape. So it was an act. When he pled guilty in June, again, he went back into that act where you couldn't understand what he was saying when he said, I'm guilty. Yes, I did that. He's acting again like a 110-year-old man. Yeah.
So have they haven't sentenced him yet. It's coming up real soon, isn't it?
It's going to be August the 17th.
Okay. And are you going to be there?
I hope to, yes. Yeah. And
you haven't spoken with this guy, have you?
No, none of us
have.
What
would you say to him? If you walked into a room with him, what would you say to him?
The first thing that I'd want to know is, what did I miss? How did I miss you? Because that was one thing I could not let go. I was supposed to catch him. That was my job, and I didn't. When they arrested him...
Yeah, but you did.
Yeah, but when they arrested him and called me at home, I could not sleep that night. I couldn't close my eyes.
Really?
And I called one of the victims that I'd stayed in contact with, and she started crying. And then you realized that this was closure for them. And
Will any of the victims be there,
you
think? Yes,
they will. They will be allowed to stand up and talk before he is sentenced to get their views out also. And one of the ones that I have stayed in contact with, when he was in court to plead guilty as he was leaving, she stood up in front of him and said, I hope you rot in hell. And everybody there was clapping when she did that. But she's one of the ones that really was able to live through it and get on with her life.
Yeah.
And they have helped. There's three or four victims that finally came out before he was caught. And that's what kept it going.
Yeah. Where was he living?
Living in Sacramento.
Okay. Yeah. And just a residential neighborhood?
Yes.
And I don't know, from what the neighbor said, he was just a normal, quiet person?
No, he wasn't a normal, quiet person. He was good at keeping the landscape and everything, but he had his daughter living with him, and he would be yelling and screaming at her.
Really?
And there was times he would be in the backyard, and they would hear him yelling and screaming, and they'd look over the fence, and there'd be nobody back there except him.
Wow.
So, there's... Larry, there's a lot we need to learn.
We're just about out of time here, but I've got 1,000 more questions I could ask you on this thing. We could talk for another show. Would you come back after the sentencing and fill us in on exactly what's happened on this thing?
Certainly.
The book is called Sudden Terror. Where can people find this book? It's an incredible book. I'm on my second read through this thing.
It's on Amazon. You can get it in hardcover, softcover, or Kindle.
Okay, great. And Larry, good job. It took a few years, but you got your man.
Yeah, we did. But like I said, it took civilians also to keep this going. And it was something that I could not let go. Even after I retired, I couldn't let it go. It was just too important. And when he was finally caught, it was just unbelievable.
We are just about out of time for today's show. Remember, you can catch our show every Saturday at 10 a.m. and a replay Sundays at 6 p.m. right here on Salem's original radio station, KSLM. A reminder, if you missed any of today's show or would like to hear any of my shows, you can always hear a podcast on our official KSLM website at www.kslm.news or on my official website at www.terrysaul.com. If you would like to drop me a note, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is terry@kslm.news. We'll see you next time. Take care and be safe.
You've been listening to The Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM KSLM. Today's show is brought to you by the Lule Group, featuring Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule's State Farm Insurance. That's a wrap. Thanks, everybody. Good show.
Bye, everybody.